appropriate for children under 13. Now playing. For tickets and information, go to samson.movie.
And with a look at things going on around the world, here is USA Radio Network's UN correspondent, Luke Vargas.
An economic assessment by Smith College professor Andrew Zimbalist finds South Korea spent roughly $13 billion to host the ongoing Winter Olympics, but will generate less than $3 billion in short-term revenue. South Korea's government optimistically says hosting the Games will draw in at least $18 billion in revenue in the coming years, but Zimbalist is skeptical, saying meager ticket sales show the challenge of turning Pyeongchang into a popular international resort town. Reuters reports up to 100 Russian mercenaries may have been killed in eastern Syria last week after the U.S. responded with force to an assault on allied Kurdish fighters. In a pattern seen in eastern Ukraine, Russian mercenaries are said to be taking on an increased role across Syria. By relying on contractors instead of uniformed personnel, Russia's government is not required to report on death tolls or injuries. And Germany's foreign minister is asking the U.S. to step up its participation in transatlantic security by doing more than funding its military. The complaint that certain German allies have rolled back spending on diplomacy and the U.N. comes days after President Trump's proposed budget spelled out steep cuts at the State Department, U.N., and USAID. But Ursula von der Leyen did propose a compromise, saying Germany would increase its military spending and push others in Europe to do so if the U.S. remained diplomatically engaged. We'll see if that message reaches Washington.
For USA Radio News, my name is Tim Berg.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com, and I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hutterton Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Good morning, Hunterdon. This is Big C coming to you from HuntertonChamberRadio.com at the studio offices of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce in Flemington, New Jersey. Good Morning Hunterdon kicks off your day by providing you with local news, traffic and weather, as well as light topics through Vitamin C, Wake Up Call, and Chamber Chat. I also have many guests focusing on Hunterdon County community, business, and education. Listen to me every weekday morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Good Morning Hunterdon, HuntertonChamberRadio.com.
You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located at the historic Large House, 119 Main Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programs.
Hello, my name is Robert Burns. My website is bobburnspeaks.com, and I'm inviting you to listen to my show at 1 o'clock on Friday afternoons on Hutterton Chamber Radio, entitled Awaken to Your Purpose. How many people walk through life awake and knowing why they were incarnated here in this beautiful planet? Not a lot of people do. I was in my late 40s by the time I found out, but now I know. So listen to the show, and maybe that'll promote you to awaken to your purpose. And thank you so much.
Well, good afternoon. A wet afternoon, but I guess some of us could be happy it's not snow. But what's predicted, hazardous weather conditions. Although with the rain, shouldn't be bad. One of the concerns, however, is what's going to happen if it gets colder, and that's what's expected. So Showers, 70% chance this afternoon. I guess we should say it's 100%. Tonight there will be clouds and low of about 24 degrees. If it gets down that low, of course, it's going to freeze. There's going to be water on the roads, and be very careful because that's what makes the driving hazardous. Tomorrow we can expect increasing clouds, high of about 39 degrees. And then into Saturday night, there's about a 90% rain and snow chance earlier, and then about a 90% chance of heavy snow, low of about 28 degrees. So be very careful tomorrow night driving, and also tomorrow morning, because it's going to be ice. Anywhere that there's been rain, it will be ice tomorrow morning. Into Sunday, should be sunny and about 47 degrees, so that'll be a nice day. But again, just also be careful, because since the snow predicted for Saturday night and low temperature, it could still be snow, and under the snow there would be ice. By Sunday night, it should be mostly clear, cold, 28 degrees, and then on Monday, and those of you who have off for Washington's birthday, there is going to be start out partly sunny, and then we have a prediction about a 60% chance of rain, high of about 49 degrees. So we'll be back right after the weather, or excuse me, right after this pot.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on 100 in Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@100-chamber.org.
Bear with me while I play a couple spots while I try to get this frog out of my throat.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
100 Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, 100inchamberradio.com, brought to you by the 100in County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, Para Planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Good afternoon. Friday, the 16th of February. Is it really? Can't believe it. Hope everybody remembered and had a wonderful Valentine's Day. I am Pat Smits. I handle divorce and family law here in Hunterdon County. And believe it or not, you know, guys need to know that even though she may say, "I don't want anything," don't listen, because You know, it's an important day, and it's an important day to think if we're lucky enough to have someone who's special in our life, that is really lucky, and we need to sit and appreciate, because too often we're so busy that we don't, and we don't think about it, and we should think about it. So what am I going to do today? Well, I thought that I might actually talk a little bit about some of the family law cases that were so important in this last year. I try not to dwell on family cases usually. On the other hand, I also have to mention this latest terrible tragedy in Florida. And I think that, you know, one more school shooting, and what the news has been saying is that this is the eighth one this year, 2018, in school, and the 18th in or around schools related to school. And I'm not sure, I know where the 18 are all around the country, and I'm not sure exactly what they include in around the school. And of course, we had the terrible tragedy in Las Vegas. Nothing seems to change. And the fact that, you know, even the people I know, responsible gun owners, recognize that assault rifles are, you know, should not be out there. I mean, we, you know, this is just tragic. And nothing will change as long as the gun lobby is as strong as it is. And I think the problem is almost overwhelming. And the two sides just don't talk. Although if you really talk to responsible hunters, and frankly, growing up in Wisconsin, you know, I had a family that hunted, I hunted, and that type of activity is a fun activity. But I don't know of any hunters who went out with automatic rifles when they were deer hunting. But in any event, I won't go further on that. The other thing in the news, of course, is the fact that we have now had a number of Russian citizens who've been indicted. What people always ask me as an attorney, well, what does that mean? Well, in this case, of course, this is federal, and Mueller is doing an investigation on the federal level, and so that there was a grand jury, a federal grand jury, and the grand jury, we also have state grand juries, and for example, many of us and many of you, not me so far, have been summoned to jury duty. And there are two types of juries, and people always ask, because this is confusing, but there is a jury, you know, there's also a petit jury. So most of us are summoned for jury duty. It's just to go into court, and here in Hunterdon County, we get a notice, and we actually can call in, and if we're not needed, we do not have to show up. I was in court in Somerville on Monday, and they obviously must have called about 100 jurors in, because the line outside to get into the courthouse took at least 20 minutes, and most of the people in that line were there for jury duty. But the grand jury is different. It's held, I think, here. It used to be. I'm not sure now in Hunterdon County. But it could be, it's not every day, may even be just once a month, it depends, and the jurors serve for a longer period of time. And what happens both in federal grand juries and, of course, a state, is the prosecutor presents a case, and then the jury, grand jury, decides whether or not to indict. So it's a very serious process. And in this case, of course, there have been a number of Russian citizens and entities who have been indicted by the federal grand jury that just came out today, and on a variety of charges, including conspiracy, and I think there was some bank fraud involved and other things, but very specifically involving the help that they gave or tried to give to Donald Trump during the campaign. So these are very serious charges, and there are other people who are, pleading guilty. The one thing that is really a shame is if people really think all of this is fake news. I don't know Mr. Mueller, but everyone who knows him says that he has just probably been the best person to conduct this investigation. They've been very thorough, and frankly, they haven't leaked. There's been a lot of speculation, but not a lot of leaks. So this is something that, it's going to go on, and it seems to be getting closer and closer to the White House. And, of course, if you really get me going, it will be the fact that we had people who did not have security. The security that they should have had, the security clearance they should have, and they were working in very sensitive positions in the White House. And, you know, it's not just a he said, she said here with respect to the two ex-wives. My understanding, although I have not specifically had the information as to exactly when, is that one of the ex-wives actually had a restraining order. Now, I hear a lot that, well, we have to wait for due process, but let's remember, in many of those cases, someone has not prosecuted. So that in domestic violence cases, it would be rare for a criminal charge to be filed unless someone ends up, severely beaten and in the hospital. At that point, there might be criminal charges. But usually what happens is at least here in New Jersey, the way we handle it, it's the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act. The victim files a complaint. It is heard, first of all, for a temporary restraining order. The victim is heard by a judge or a hearing officer who determines whether or not a temporary restraining order should be granted. And that's true in most of those cases. A temporary restraining order will be granted. And thereafter, in New Jersey, within about 10 days, there will be a hearing where both parties can be represented by attorneys, and that's a hearing to determine whether or not there will be a final restraining order. And in those cases, both parties should have attorneys, especially the person who's being accused of domestic violence and when a temporary restraining order has been issued, because there are very serious consequences once there is a final restraining order. It continues. And in fact, I have a case where I'm representing a former husband in a situation where he was the one who was able to obtain a final restraining order in 2004. And that continues. And in this particular case that I'm thinking of, it should continue because his ex is pretty crazy. And what happened is she, threatened and harassed and subsequently threatened, harassed his wife, his children, etc. So, but there can be very serious implications for jobs. There are, very serious. In other words, anyone should be really very, very careful and should be represented. And there are cases where these are basically set up by someone who wants to get an advantage in a divorce case. And when that happens, that's really outrageous. So let me, I'll come back and get off my tirade and talk a little bit about the family law cases that were important this past year once I have you hear from some of our sponsors.
Advancing Hunterdon is an ever-sharp focus on the growth and prosperity of Hunterdon County's businesses. Advancing Hunterdon engages businesses within and throughout the county that are responsive to a call to action as the next chapter in business success. If your business and organization wants to get engaged, contact the Chamber today. at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. Advancing Hunterdon, a roadmap for economic growth for the business community of Hunterdon.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm chairman of the Ambassadors Committee of the Chamber. As members of the Ambassadors Committee, we contact new and renewing members of the Chamber to get their feedback on their Chamber experience and make them feel more at home with the Chamber.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Okay, we're back, and I'm going to just talk about some cases that certainly the really mostly affected family law matters, but this, in fact, one is a civil procedure. It would not be limited to family law, and this was a Chancery Division case, K.A. versus J.L., and it was the opinion was by Judge Hansberry, and the issue in that case is, can a court assert personal jurisdiction over an out-of-state defendant by serving an order to show cause and the complaint for injunctive relief via Facebook? Well, folks, we're really in the age of what? Certainly anybody would have mentioned to me Facebook, 15 years ago, and whether or not you could serve a defendant via Facebook, you know, first of all, people would have said, what's Facebook? And secondly, the way to obtain personal jurisdiction is to serve the person in the state. So in general, a litigant, a defendant in New Jersey, if a New Jersey court is going to exercise jurisdiction, the defendant has to be served in New Jersey. Now, there are certain other methods to do it, but the holding in this case is that a court in New Jersey can assert personal jurisdiction if certain procedural requirements are met. So in this case, K.A., the plaintiffs in the case are the child's adoptive parents, and they filed an application requesting an order to enjoin the defendant from contacting their son. And they also then sought leave to effectuate what we call substituted service via Facebook after certified mail was unsuccessful. So that there are ways to, if the person, the defendant is not in New Jersey, there are times where if you serve based on certified mail, that will be successful. But in this case, it was a family law case, and the adoptive parents claimed that the defendant reached out to their adoptive son via Facebook and Instagram. So in other words, the defendant made contact with their adoptive son via Facebook and also Instagram and said that he was, in fact, their adoptive son's biological father. And they also alleged that the defendant posted a picture of the child on his Facebook, meaning the defendant's Facebook account, the biological father's Facebook account, stating that the child was his son. So apparently what happened is adoptive parents sent cease and desist letters to the defendant at his last two known addresses in Pennsylvania, and they were unclaimed. And thereafter, they sought leave to effectuate substituted service via Facebook. And as attorneys know, and as litigants find out, is to obtain personal jurisdiction over an out-of-state defendant, a plaintiff must serve the defendant personally in New Jersey. However, if the plaintiff has made a reasonable good faith attempt to effectuate personal service and is unsuccessful, then a plaintiff may serve the defendant by secondary methods, and these are prescribed in court rules, and you know, attorneys know these alternative methods. And however, one of the reasons that this was able to serve this defendant by an alternative method is that this biological father, or alleged biological father, was engaged in contact with New Jersey. We're called the forum state. And because the plaintiffs had difficulty serving the defendant personally, they required or requested that the court require the defendant, I guess I shouldn't say that, they requested that the court allow them to serve through Facebook. So then the court went on to analyze whether service of process via Facebook is proper, and Judge Hansberry considered three factors. First of all was whether the defendant can be served by conventional means, specifically provided by the court rule, and the rules provide alternative methods. And second, whether the relief sought is appropriate for service by publication. And then third, whether service via Facebook still protects a defendant's due process rights. So those are the three things that the judge had to decide. And so what Judge Hansberry did is that he found that service by Facebook was proper in this case. And he did so because the plaintiffs attempted to serve the defendant by certified mail at his two last known addresses. And the certified mail, in other words, what we do as attorneys is we file one copy via regular mail and the second via certified mail. And in this case, the certified mailings were not claimed, but the regular mail had not been returned. So generally, there's an expectation if the, in this case, that the defendant did receive the regular mail because the post office did not return that. So apparently, there was no forwarding address available. And then the court determined that actual service was necessary in this case, because the plaintiff sought to enjoin the defendant from contacting their son via social media websites and wanted his previous contact in doing that stopped. So the court also was concerned about would he get the transmission via fax, Facebook. And since Facebook was purported the vehicle in which used to harm the child, that was relevant. And also the Facebook account had been active. So they were able to find out the defendant's Facebook account had been active. And the also court further indicated that the Facebook message, or the Facebook Messenger, I should say, has a read receipt feature which alerts the sender when the recipient has opened the message. So in other words, if you serve, and in this case, if they served via Facebook, the recipient would be able to not be able to block the sender from finding out when it was opened. And in this case also, the defendant appeared by telephone for the court hearing, which establishes that he was served. And therefore, the court found that due process was satisfied in serving the defendant and therefore granted the plaintiff's request for an injunction. So what happened in this case is they were able to confirm that the defendant was served by Facebook. Now, there's was a constitutional issue that came up in a case, and these cases are 2017, and they were fact, all published cases, so they are precedential value, although the Judge Hansberry, that case would not be precedent because Judge Hansberry at the time was sitting in the Chancery Division. That means he was sitting as a trial court. So another trial court would not have to follow that opinion if they felt that they didn't want to. But on some basis, they'd have to do the same kind of analysis that Judge Hansberry did. But in fact, if they decided based on their analysis that they would not allow service by Facebook, via Facebook, they wouldn't have to follow that. It's only trial judges only have to follow appellate cases when they're published. So this next case that I'm talking about, ES versus HA, was in fact published. And the issue was, did the provisions in an order requiring the defendant to admit to sexually abusing his son prior to making an application for parenting time violate the defendant's constitutional right against self-incrimination? And the appellate division, in an opinion by Judge Massano, held yes. And the court found that the defendant sexually abused his son, and the order granted the plaintiff sole legal and physical custody of the son and denied the defendant parenting time. And the order also required the defendant to comply with the following: 1, admission of wrongdoing; 2, a psychosexual evaluation by a professional specializing in this type of an evaluation; and 3, individual therapy. Now, the appellate division held that the trial court violated the defendant's constitutional right under the Fifth Amendment of the state constitution. The orders did not allow the defendant to petition the family part for modification unless the defendant admitted to the wrongdoing. So this constituted a compelled waiver of the defendant's constitutional right against self-incrimination. And it also violated his rights to invoke the equitable powers of the family court to modify its order denying him parenting time. And the order further inhibited the defendant from requesting a review of the order, and the court should not have reached that conclusion in advance of such a request. So, therefore, the appellate division vacated these provisions of the order. Doesn't mean that this man will ever be awarded any type of parenting time with the son, just that the court couldn't put in these were constitutionally prohibited conditions. So there's there was another case on, you know, what does a child have as far as rights? In New Jersey, parents can be required to pay for college for a child. And even though the child is over the age of 18, these are a long string of cases. This most recent case was an opinion by Judge Lihotz, it's Lihotz, just a terrific judge. She was on the appellate division, and unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, depending on your viewpoint, she has retired. She's now doing mediation, arbitration, and she's back in private practice with a firm. Unfortunately for us, not in this area. But she is, her opinion, she's probably the most prolific opinion writer in family law cases since Justice Long. The case is Rishi versus Rishi, R-I-C-C-I versus Rishi. And the issue, first issue was, can a child intervene in a post-divorce matter to compel the parents to pay for her education when the parents executed a consent order that declared the child as emancipated? So that first holding by the appellate division was yes, and the court held that the child had an interest in the matter and thus had the ability to intervene. However, what happened is the appellate division remanded the case to the lower court to make proper factual findings consistent with the court's opinion to determine whether or not the child should be emancipated. And in this case, and then the second issue was, to what extent are parents required to contribute to their 19-year-old child's college education. And in that case, for that issue, the court held that to determine whether parents are required to contribute to college tuition requires the court to analyze the factors under Newberg versus Arrigo. And that was a longstanding case the courts have used to make that determination. And what the appellate division stated is if the trial court found that the daughter, Caitlin, was not emancipated, then the trial court needs to engage in a two-part analysis to determine to what extent her parents should contribute to her college education. The first would be whether equitable or other considerations mitigate against the parents paying college costs, and secondly, whether the parents are financially capable of contributing. Frankly, too often trial courts don't make that analysis. But in any event, the appellate division explained that the court should review whether the child was involving his or her parents in the selection of the school, the extent of the child's relationship with the parents, the financial obligations of the parents, and other contributions from financial aid or scholarships the child was eligible for. So, not a slam dunk, but in New Jersey, one of the few states that can require parents to pay for college. Now, interestingly, if the divorce takes place in a state that doesn't require parents to pay for college, unless the parents have agreed in an agreement to do so, New Jersey cannot change that, because that issue would have to go back to the court in the other state. Now, likewise, courts in other states, if the divorce has been in New Jersey, should send that question back to a New Jersey court if it comes up. All right, let's see. What's the next? This is also an interesting case, BG versus LH. Now, the cases that I've mentioned that have initials, the reason for that is usually either the sensitive nature of the case, such as the case where the father, the court found that he had, in fact, sexually abused the child. Obviously, the court is not going to use names because of the child's privacy. Apparently the court didn't feel it was necessary in Rishi. The issue in that case, of course, was the college issue, and initials were used by Judge Hansberry. Again, that would be protection in that case of a child who was adopted. So the next case I wanted to talk about was BG versus LH, and that was a Chancery Division trial court opinion, and the question was, does New Jersey have jurisdiction over custody and parenting time issues when New Jersey entered the initial custody order, but the mother and children now reside in another state? And the holding in that case was yes, and in that case, the agreement provided that New Jersey would retain jurisdiction if a parenting dispute arose, as long as one parent resided in New Jersey. And the parties agreed to joint legal custody, and in that case, the father enjoyed parenting time with the children in New Jersey, and New Jersey has jurisdiction over custody and parenting time issues. And based on New Jersey, New Jersey entered the initial order, only New Jersey can determine whether or not New Jersey has lost jurisdiction. And the court in that case found it had jurisdiction and found it appropriate to retain jurisdiction rather than relinquish jurisdiction to Massachusetts. And in that case, the judge engaged in a three-step analysis and considered, first, whether it has continuing exclusive jurisdiction. Second, whether the circumstances have changed to divest the state of jurisdiction. And three, whether New Jersey is an inconvenient forum, and if so, whether the foreign state is the more appropriate forum. And that's unfortunately what often happens in cases when a parent has been allowed to relocate to another state, either by agreement or court order. And the step one is pretty easy, because New Jersey acquires exclusive continuing jurisdiction when the state makes the initial custody determination or modifies a custody determination by another state. Here, the court acquired exclusive continuing jurisdiction because New Jersey made the initial custody determination. So then under step two, under our statute, exclusive and continuing jurisdiction remains until neither the child and one parent, nor the child and a person acting as a parent have significant connection with this state, and substantial evidence is no longer available in this state concerning the child's care, protection, training, and personal relationships, or the court of this state or a court of another state determines that neither the child nor a parent nor any person acting as a parent presently resides in this state. So once the court determines it has continuing jurisdiction, as it did in this particular case, then the court has to determine whether it's an inconvenient forum. And that's where so often that actually happens. Even though a parent continues to live in New Jersey, very often it's the father who continues to live in New Jersey, and then a trial court will decline jurisdiction. So what the trial court is required to do under that step is consider whether New Jersey is an inconvenient forum and whether the foreign court is a more convenient forum. Well, it's not very difficult for a trial judge who especially doesn't want to have one more case on his or her docket to say, wait, the child or children have been living in the other state for maybe a number of years. The school is there. All of their activities are there. The court in that other jurisdiction is more convenient. And, you know, I'm kind of simplifying this because in this case, eight factors were considered in making decision. First was whether there was domestic violence, whether it had occurred or is likely to continue in the future. That's usually not the issue. Second, the length of time the child has resided outside the state. That's a big problem when the child has resided out of state for a number of years. And then the distance between the court in this state and the court in the state that would assume jurisdiction. Four, the relative financial circumstances of the parties. Five, any agreement of the parties as to which state should assume jurisdiction. And six, the nature and location of the residences. Six is actually the nature and location of the evidence required to resolve the pending litigation. And again, very often the school records and the any other witnesses will now have been in the other state. And seven, the ability of the court in each state to decide the issue expeditiously. So often in that circumstance, New Jersey will say, wait, we're so backlogged, and the other state can do it expeditiously, so we will decline jurisdiction. However, also the procedures necessary to present evidence. And then number eight, the familiarity of the court of each state with the facts and issues in the pending litigation. So the important issue here is that, and probably the more important, and I haven't talked about it, is that now the issue is the question of the Bisbing case, because it has changed, significantly changed the focus to when someone wants to move out of state, unless there's an agreement, the court has to focus on what is in the best interest of the children or child. This decision was, memory serves me, August 8th, 2017. I was in the middle of and have just finished, but not received a decision, in a relocation case where the mother wants to move the child out of state. Father didn't agree. Under the prior case law, Supreme Court case, the focus was really on the mother and whether or not she could prove certain initial things, and then basically whether it was in her best interest and she had a bona fide reason to move, and then the parent who was not wanting the move to take place had to sustain the burden to keep the child here. Now it's just what is the child's best interest. So let's. I'll be back shortly after talking, just giving you a little more information about some of our sponsors.
¿Sabía que de cada cinco personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental? NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's physician referral service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Hi again. The program It's the Law. I'm Pat Smits, and I've been reviewing some of the important cases, the most important cases that generally family law cases, but you know, one of them, of course, dealt with civil procedure and whether or not a court here can exercise personal jurisdiction. And believe me, if you're ever involved in a case where you have to get jurisdiction over an out-of-state person or entity, it can be very daunting. And, of course, we also had a constitutional issue in a case where the defendant was not required to incriminate himself, and no one is required to incriminate themselves in this country. That's the constitutional protection both under the U.S. and state constitutions. So that if you're charged with any kind of criminal action, you absolutely do not need to say anything. And that's why you're given what we call the Miranda rights, and you're told that you do not have to say anything. And we won't go back into how that came about, but that was a case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. If I recall, it might have been a Florida case, and but it does have very serious consequences if someone has not read their, what we call read their rights. The case now that I want to talk about is a domestic violence case. It's a case under the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act, and it was an appellate division case. Again, we have initials, LC, VMAJ, again, to protect the parties. And the issue in this case is that whether or not the trial court committed an error by considering the defendant's in limine motion to dismiss plaintiff's domestic violence complaint on the day of the final hearing. And what the appellate division said is, yes, the trial court did commit an error in considering the defendant's in limine motion. Now, by considering that motion on the day of a final hearing, the court deprived the alleged domestic violence victim of due process. And moreover, the defendant's application was effectively a summary judgment motion, and the court failed to provide the plaintiff with all the benefits and reasonable inferences required. So in this case, they reversed and remanded before a different judge. So they thought it was significant enough to, in this case, send it to a different judge to hear. So what happened? The plaintiff filed a domestic violence complaint based on harassment, and the plaintiff alleged a history of domestic violence that included past physical abuse and other controlling conduct. So at the final hearing, before hearing any testimony, the defendant sought to dismiss the plaintiff's complaint via what we call an in limine motion. And without hearing any testimony, the court granted the motion and dismissed the complaint. So the appellate division found that the defendant did not seek what they called a resolution of a preliminary or evidentiary issue. Now, that's what the basis for a proper, what we call in limine, and I'll spell that, I-N-L-space-L-I-M-I-N-E, and of course it's a foreign word. So an in limine motion is brought to resolve preliminary issues or evidentiary issues, and they're not for substantive issues. So in this case, the appellate division said that the trial judge erred in considering the motion instead of rejecting it outright, so that this motion should have been rejected outright. Because in the context of a domestic violence matter, in fact, this court, the appellate division, said they condemned the use of an in limine motion where the alleged victim's safety and well-being are the prime considerations. So in this case, by even considering this application, the court deprived the plaintiff of the opportunity to respond or oppose the motion. And the appellate division also noted that if, in fact, the defendant had grounds to dismiss, the proper procedure would have been for the defendant to present such an application after plaintiff presented her case or at the close of the evidence. So this was an improper motion. Also, apparently, the trial judge treated the motion as a motion for summary judgment. And that's the way that apparently the trial court treated it. And as the defendant's arguments
were not that the plaintiff failed to set forth a claim for which relief might not be granted, but the allegation was that the act complained of, the harassment complained of, did not constitute harassment under the statute. So, in effect, it was just like a summary judgment motion saying, hey, there was nothing there. And so in that case, however, the court had to view the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. And here the trial court was in error because it accepted the bona fides of the defendant's communication that were without support and failed to allow the plaintiff to provide the plaintiff with any benefit of any inferences that she was entitled to in connection with the summary judgment application. So, in fact, if the defendant had waited until after the plaintiff testified, then he could properly have made a motion to dismiss based on the fact that she was unable to meet her burden of proof. In any event, the appellate division in that case reinstated the temporary restraining order and remanded for a final hearing before a different judge. So this makes sense for attorneys, and, of course, it's a procedural case, so maybe that's not of a lot of interest to other people, but it's certainly an interest to attorneys and also to show that the appellate courts are going to be very careful with in limine motions, especially in a domestic violence case. I have a little bit of time. I wanted to tell you about one more case, and again, this was an opinion by Judge Lyhos, and it's RG versus RG, believe it or not, same initials. And the issue was whether the trial court erred in imposing a restraining order where defendant argues that the family part lacked jurisdiction to enter a final restraining order, where the predicate act and facts were insufficient to warrant the entry of a final restraining order, especially in light of various evidentiary rulings. So, again, another domestic violence case. Very often they go up on appeal. And the holding by the appellate division was that based on the amended jurisdictional provision in the statute, the appellate division held that the court had jurisdiction over defendant as they were previously household members. However, based upon the court's improper consideration of character evidence and hearsay and other reasons, there was no basis to conclude that the conflict between the parties constituted domestic violence, or that there was any need for a final restraining order for the plaintiff's immediate protection or to prevent further abuse. So in that case, they reversed the trial court. And this was a case that involved two older brothers who had not lived together in over 30 years. So this was a real basis for this, and the court could have, depending on the circumstances, entered a restraining order. But in this case, the court found that it was just not proper. So in any event, that's about all we have for today, and this brings you up to date on some of the cases last year that were decided. And one of the things that trial courts, they're in a tough position. They have too many cases, especially these domestic violence cases, and they just, we need more judges, although we have probably more judges now than we've had at any time that I know in the past 10 years. So in any event, until next week, I hope next week, we'll be back, and we'll go to the news.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News.
The FBI acknowledged that some protocols were not followed after they obtained a tip in January that shooting suspect Nicholas Cruz had a potential of conducting a school shooting. Meanwhile, a former classmate of Cruz is coming out speaking about some of the things he did in his past school years.
I used to always hear stories about him.